TD, you're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Karen Sconsert, an associate professor of education at Carthage College, Jeff Rasmussen, a retired Racine Unified teacher and administrator who currently serves as president of the Racine Area Retired Educators Association, Steve Brown, a retired professor of educational leadership, and former Kenosha Unified School Superintendent Joe Mangi. Now, here's today's Education Matters moderator.
Hello, I'm Karen Sconsert, and this is Education Matters. Mental health has been and remains a challenging topic for many Americans to understand. Sometimes we use pejorative terms to describe people with mental illness. We are concerned about the stigma of being labeled as mentally ill, and at the same time, we seem to recognize that mental health is an important precursor to success in the world, in the home, in relationships, and especially in school. According to statistics provided by the National Alliance on Mental Illness, 1 in 6 youth ages 6 to 17 experience a mental health challenge each year. This equates to approximately 140,000 school-age children in Wisconsin alone in any given school year. Of today's youth struggling with mental health challenges, only about 50% are accessing treatment and support services. Many school districts are innovating their approach to mental health, and Kenosha Unified School District is among them. So here with us today to talk about mental health issues in the schools and new services being offered are Bridget Kotarek, who is in her third year serving as Director of Special Education and Student Support at KUSD. Prior to joining Kenosha Unified, she served in other Wisconsin school districts as Director of Special Education, Principal, Assistant Principal, and a Special Education Teacher. Welcome, Bridget.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Leah Featherstone is the Clinical Director for Professional Services Group Incorporated, a private social service agency. Hi, Leah.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Dana Bilevsky serves as a psychologist and the coordinator of school-based programs for PSG. Over the last several years, PSG's school-based programming has grown significantly, and they continue to expand within Kenosha Unified and surrounding districts. PSG's mission is to provide quality, effective services to communities and families, and school-based services have allowed PSG to serve a tremendous amount of students and families in the community. So, first question for Bridget is, how do you define mental health for young children? How would you know if they're really having a problem in not just a quirky personality or misbehaving or some of the other things that families sometimes think are happening?
Sure, I think that's a really great question. I think it's easy for us, or maybe typically we think about mental health and wellness as just falling solely in that psychological component. But for us, when we think about mental health and wellness of our students in our schools, we think of it much more broadly, as probably do my colleagues and friends here from PSG, is that it's not only making sure our youth have psychological and developmentally appropriate mental health and wellness, but also ensuring that they have sound, developmentally appropriate social skills, emotional skills. And so we approach and think about mental health for young children and young adults in a broader perspective beyond just that typical psychological thinking about mental health and wellness.
Okay. And for the next question, either Dana or Leah, either one of you can take this. How do mental health challenges affect a child's progress at school?
I think that can take a variety of different components and aspects for kids. We firmly believe, and we say it regularly, that behavior is language, particularly for kids and younger kids who don't have adequate verbal skills to communicate what's going on with them. Often behavioral problems or issues or just different behaviors for them are the first sign you're going to see that there's something going on. And that generally is what gets us involved, where we're seeing some kind of behavior in the classroom. But from a long-term perspective, it makes it really hard for them to learn, makes it really hard for them to even stay in the class, to develop appropriate social relationships because they struggle with their peers. It can really affect every aspect when you think about kids being in the school building. Any kind of mental health concern can derail their development kind of across the board.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Another statistic Bridget sent me a few short articles before while I was preparing for this. Another statistic in that article is the average classroom has at least 5 students with serious mental health needs, 1 struggling with severe abuse, and 10 living in poverty. And of course, that's average, so there would be some where those numbers are higher or lower. Schools must support the mental health needs and social-emotional development of all kids for them to be successful despite any obstacles they face. So thinking about the classroom as a whole, so I'm going to ask Dana this question. If these challenges aren't treated, what happens in that classroom? You know, not talking about the individual student, or I don't know, maybe Bridget's a better person to answer that since you're a special educator at one point.
Well, I think the challenge really affects a child's ability to engage in the learning opportunities planned and offered by the school and teacher. Certainly, it presents a challenge, a new type of challenge for a classroom teacher because there's always a wide range of skills in children, and then unaddressed mental health challenges is just an added layer of complexity to public education and educating all kids well today. But I like to think of it more as the untreated or unaddressed mental health challenge really just affects the child's ability to participate in that learning environment.
Right. So then my next question, and this one you can answer, Dana, is, so I remember talking about this topic. I prepare future teachers, so I have a lot of students who just came out of high school, and they tell me that in some schools, and particularly in suburban districts, they're offering counselor services that the students would normally go to after school. They give them space within the school building so they can do it during the school day, and then the parents don't have to drive them and they don't have to take them out of school or whatever. So obviously this is a trend in some places. Is there just a trend toward increasing need for mental health in schools, or is it just we're diagnosing them better, or what's going on with that?
I think with the availability of the therapy services in the school, we're reaching students who otherwise wouldn't be able to access the service. We're seeing a lot of students who, for one reason or another, wouldn't be able to get to an outpatient clinic, for example, and they're experiencing mental health treatment for the first time, which is, you know, I think helping them in the classroom environment and other ways in their life.
So it may be that there isn't a change in the actual number of students with needs. It's just that now they're being recognized and sometimes met. Is that it? Or is there an increase in need?
I think there is. I think it's a system-wide piece. I think in society we're more aware of mental illness or mental wellness. Yeah. And I know in KUSD in particular, there's a push for that and training at all the schools about mental health, you know, trauma, attachment, all those kind of things. So I think staff in general in a school are more aware of school, of mental health issues and how they present for a student, whether it's externalizing issues or internalizing issues. So the student that acts out in the classroom versus the student who is quiet and, you know, just having negative thoughts about themselves in their head, that those students also get services. So I think it's just a overall bigger issue that we discuss now, so there are more students that are coming forward and being referred for services.
Okay, so that's sort of all the background to this. What we really want to talk about here is what is the approach that KUSD is taking now. I know that you had a pilot at Bullen Middle School and Bradford High School that was last year. Is that correct?
We started it in the 2017-18 school year. So we're two plus years into our partnership with Professional Services Group in bringing school-based counseling services, as you just briefly discussed, into our schools. And we started as a pilot program in the fall of 2017, bringing those services directly to students at Bullen and Bradford. And since then, we've expanded to having those services available to students in 17 of our 42 school campuses.
So does that include elementary schools?
Yep, it's K-12.
Okay.
And so we started with Bullen and Bradford and have systematically added schools in a feeder school pattern. So looking at what other schools feed into Bullen, into Bradford, and working out from there. So as students move from one school to the next, that they still have access to services.
How did you select the schools? Was it just a perception of need or a lack of services in those neighborhoods, or how did you?
Those two schools in particular, Bullen and Bradford, were selected actually before I started working for the district in July of 2017. I can only speculate, but I anticipate there's need, and then also probably most likely school principals who are open to the idea and looking for new approaches and new ways to help students in need.
Okay, that makes sense.
Certainly every school in our in our community, in every community, has the need to varying degrees.
Right. I suppose in the past, if students had a diagnosed mental health need, then it was up to the parents to find a practitioner, take them out of school or make appointments after school, and get them there themselves.
Correct. And so I always thought of it as, you know, all of our school-based mental health or school-based counselors and social workers often have been really good at referring families to services like professional services group when they identify a need a student might have beyond what they are trained to support. And then usually, typically, when we provide that information to them about where they can access help, the system would just sit and hope.
Oh.
We hope that they call. We hope that they, you know, are able to connect with those providers for help. But as we know, a lot of families in our communities have a lot of barriers to access.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes well-intentioned parents struggle to follow through on that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's true of all of us in some aspect of our own lives, too. Sometimes that follow through is difficult. So what's great about having school-based services co-located right in our schools is that we break down, as Dana mentioned previously, that access barriers, whether it be time, transportation, support in navigating a system that might not be very, very familiar to them. So we kind of remove as many of those access barriers that we that there often are for connecting a child or a family to therapy services.
Okay, I'm going to take a quick reintroduction break. You are listening to WGTD HDFM. I'm your host, Karen Sconzert, and this is Education Matters. This discussion of Kenosha Unified School District's school-based mental health program is archived at WGTD.org. And it is also on the Education Matters page at WGTD.org. You are invited to listen again, or you can find our WGTD Education Matters Facebook page and join in a discussion there. Sorry, for some reason, I'm having tangled tongue with WGTD today. It is a little bit of a mouthful,
yes.
I have to say. So let's get into this. How is a student identified for treatment? And once identified, when are the programs available? So Leah or Dana, either one of you could talk to that.
So the programs are available throughout the school day at those identified schools that we're in. Generally, we will have a point person or two in each building identified who kind of streamlines referrals for us and is kind of the gatekeeper so that referrals aren't coming from everywhere within the building. So that identified person will is the one who sends the referral to us.
Right. So it's usually the school social worker or psychologist in the school, something like that.
Right.
So most likely part of the chain is a teacher maybe notices, or even the child themselves identify that they are having some issues and they need some help. And then it goes to the counselor or the social worker or the school psychologist. And then they say, yes, this is definitely someone who needs some treatment.
Correct. Or the school team, school counselors and social workers might be already working together in support of this student and recognize that there could be just an added layer of support that could really help this student, a level of care beyond which school staff are trained or licensed to provide.
So then at what point are the parents incorporated into this?
The parents are sometimes the referral source as well.
Oh,
sometimes
okay.
The parents will approach school staff saying, you know, there's you know, some difficulties at home or, you know, something like that, that they'll say, can we get the student in for some services here at the school?
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes they are the referral source. In overall, the parents do come in. We do the initial intake session with them and involve them in the process, as we would with if it was traditionally an outpatient setting. And then the therapists that see the children reach out to the parents at least once a month to provide updates on their student and what they're doing in, you know, in therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And the parents are allowed to come in for sessions if they want, family session, for example, or to discuss something that's going on in the home. That's as it would be in a traditional outpatient setting.
Okay. So if, for example, I'm thinking about high school students, teenagers who might feel like they need some help with any number of issues, including perhaps relationships with their own parents. Is there a consent issue involved there? I know this is really complicated, but I'm sure people are thinking about this as they listen, mm-hmm. right?
Best practice is we get consent from the parent. Age of consent for mental health is 14.
Oh.
So by law, we could see a 14-year-old without parental consent. We don't tend to do that. Certainly if we had a high school student who came and said they wanted therapy, by law we could do that. But I can't think of very many times I don't think that we've done that. So best practice for us is that the parents consent to treatment of their kids. Oftentimes that also is because we're billing the parents' insurance, and mm-hmm. so the parents are generally going to know that the service is happening anyway, and they have to consent for us to bill their insurance and that kind of thing. But legally, the age of consent is 14 in the state of Wisconsin.
Oh, okay.
Consent-wise, as far as what's talked about in session, though, therapists do not disclose that
right.
Other than generally to parents and school staff,
mm-hmm.
Unless there's danger, you know,
safety issue.
Safety
right,
issue. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So what are the biggest barriers to engaging students in treatment? So, you know, you've knocked down one of them by putting it into the school where the students are, but are there any issues around teachers or other staff buying in or principals or any of that?
From my perspective, no. In fact, it's very well received in our schools by our staff, including our teachers and our principals. Many principals are very excited for when it's their turn mm-hmm. To receive the services. So typically at the beginning of every school semester, we're adding 2 to 5 schools, and everyone is anxiously awaiting when it's their school's turn, because they see on a daily basis kids who are struggling for a whole variety of reasons, externalizing behaviors, internalizing behaviors, and they're anxious and motivated to bring additional services to their school community and their students.
Mm-hmm. From a logistical perspective, some of the barriers are getting in contact with parents and having the parents get to us to sign consent paperwork, just the legal consent paperwork that we have to have in order to treat a child. We do have some insurance barriers of kids who are uninsured or underinsured that sometimes make treatment difficult. But we have not run into any barriers as far as like a collaboration with the schools or the district or teachers or principals or anything like that.
Do you provide any support, or as my friend that posed this question said, psychoeducation to the other staff? Is there a need for that, like for teachers to receive services or to receive training for how to best support the students in their class who are receiving services?
Right. Through our partnership with PSG, the direct therapy services are just for students.
Mm-hmm.
But we receive that question a lot because mental health and wellness is not an issue that's just contained to youth. We want many well people in our system, but at this time it's just students who are served. But we have a rich history of providing professional learning for staff around these topics. And I think learning about the impact of trauma, adverse childhood experiences, and toxic stress was our first huge undertaking as a district as far as universal professional learning for staff. And that really started to get underway, I believe, back around 2014. Since that time, we've continued professional learning around mental health and wellness topics. We currently have 6 district staff who are instructors in youth mental health first aid course.
Oh, nice.
So we're starting to offer that to KUSD staff, and that's been this is our first year of offering the course and very well received. So we look for different avenues to provide universal training across the district, and then also specific training for different employee groups or schools who have unique interests or needs on this topic.
Hmm. I went through the mental health first aid curriculum that we offered at Carthage a few times a year, so all the faculty can go through if they want it. And it was very helpful. I mean, it wasn't entirely surprising because since I work with future teachers, we talk all about mandated reporting and those kinds of things, and they do research projects around the kinds of things that secondary students would face, you know, that they might see in their classroom. But I found, so just listeners, if it ever comes up that you can take the mental health first aid training, it is great to have it in the same way that you'd want to have first aid training for physical injury or whatever. It's just a really terrific thing, I think.
Correct. And our KOSD instructors were starting to partner a little bit more with Kenosha County staff who have been trained in teaching the course. And so we'll definitely be promoting more community-based trainings for both adult mental health first aid and youth mental health first aid. Right. And we were supported in getting instructors that trained was through the Department of Justice safety grant the district received. So that supported instructor training for that course for us.
Right. Is there any other kind of training for teachers, such as maybe how to make their classrooms more friendly or appropriate for students who are suffering from anxiety or depression, which are very, very common mental health challenges?
So as Bridget,
wants to talk about that.
As Bridget mentioned, we've partnered with them since about 2013, 2014, doing trauma-sensitive education training. We've done just about every school in the district at this point, and KUSD has even done some smaller kind of follow-up trainings on that. And we consult with the schools that we're in, certainly for the school-based mental health regularly. And part of that is how do you create what we would call like a trauma-informed classroom? How do you make sure that your approach with kids, even the amount of stimuli in your room, the seating arrangements, your tone of voice, your posture, all of that, how does that impact kids and their ability to stay in the classroom, their perception of safety in the classroom, and then which ultimately affects their ability to learn overall. So we work pretty closely with different buildings and teachers on just that topic.
Right. I think the other piece that we also talk about is the teacher's impact on how present they are, how regulated they are in the moment, because obviously they bring their own stressors and whatnot into a classroom. On a good day, it's not too bad, but you know, on a rougher day, it might be more of an issue for them. So a lot of that training also talks about self-care for the educator, how to regulate themselves if there's a particular student that you know, is giving them a rough time that day that they're having a hard time with. So that's a big piece too, and the support that we offer also in the school-based mental health is to help them, help teachers with that, consult on particular students or a particular class that might be more challenging or behaviors that are going on for that particular student or staff member.
I think that's a really important point, Dana, because one of the major things we do teach in our training for staff is that for children with mental health challenges who come from very high-stress backgrounds, a calm and regulated adult means for them a safe adult. And so a lot of this work is really about the adults in the system too, their wellness, how are we preparing ourselves to come into a day that's going to present a lot of challenges, and then what's in our toolbox to ensure that we're in a great place to be that self, that safe and caring and consistent adult for children who have a lot going on in their lives that's often out of their control.
Right. And there is that, what the way that you put it was self-care. I think that's really important. And I actually do talk with my students about this. We read a book that was written a couple, 20 years ago or so, called And Still We Rise, which is about, oh, you know the book. It's about a group of students who are gifted, but they live in a high poverty environment in South Central Los Angeles. And they have two different teachers who have very, very different mental health frames of mind, one of whom seems to have slipped a bit on the self-care and then is not a stable, calm adult, even though they like her a lot and they learn from her. It is not a person who is sort of exhibiting the kind of environment that a lot of these traumatized children need. And the other one is the opposite, who is, you know, sort of very stable family person who sort of, you know, provides kind of this lighthouse for the students in that program. And so I think, you know, none of us can be perfect teachers or perfect adults all the time, but to be, it's a little bit like putting on your own oxygen mask first if you're on the airline. That's what if you've ever flown, you know that talk that the stewardess, the flight attendants give you is to put on your own oxygen mask first and then assist people next to you. And that seems to be sort of really what we're talking about.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Right.
The other important piece is that we don't just do these trainings and try to help educators figure out which kids have significant trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And we often say, like, we're not teaching for those kids. We're teaching for everybody in the school, everybody in the community.
Mm-hmm.
That even children who don't come from disadvantaged backgrounds or have had a significant trauma in their life are impacted and do benefit mm-hmm. from this type of calm, consistent instructor in front mm-hmm. of them or adults in their lives in general.
Right. It's good for everyone.
Right.
No one really wants a boss who rants. So why would you want a teacher who does that?
Right.
Right?
Exactly.
So other thing that might be helpful for teachers is, you know, students who have mental health challenges might learn differently.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the thought that really came to my mind in sort of thinking this through is, students with anxiety probably don't love having to make presentations, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes maybe they can go through, you know, work through it and achieve, but other times it may be they avoid it or skips class or something like that, and it kind of becomes this vicious cycle. So are there any alternatives for students who are just sort of so needy, have mental health issues that really are going to interfere with sort of normal functioning in the classroom? I know we try to differentiate what we teach,
mm-hmm.
but beyond that, are there alternatives like alternative classrooms, alternative schools, that sort of thing?
Yeah, throughout the district, you know, we do have some schools that are alternative high schools, offer
mm-hmm.
Are smaller in size. Some students, you know, coming to a large comprehensive high school of 1,600 to 2,200 kids isn't a right fit for them. So I think as a district, we're proud that we have a variety of choice schools available for students to find that right fit for them, whether it be educationally, socially, or emotionally. I think high quality instruction in any classroom is going to really differentiate,
mm-hmm.
as you mentioned, and then provide a variety of options for kids to show what they know and can do, and what I call and others call voice and choice.
Mm-hmm.
So how can we allow all kids a voice in how they demonstrate what mm-hmm. they know and how they learn it, and then choice in ways to demonstrate that understanding. And so even just that voice and choice piece is a very effective trauma responsive practice that helps children feel and young adults in the driver's seat a little bit more with their education, knowing what their own personal preferences and struggles are.
And I think more broadly, you know, if you're not talking about specific alternative classrooms or alternative schools, we work with teachers a lot just on understanding that different kids have different strengths, and helping them see that we can measure, we have the same expectations for kids, but we can ask them to get there maybe in a little bit of a different way. We measure progress a little bit differently. So the kid who is so anxious that they can't do classroom presentations, or that is really difficult for them, is there another way that they can demonstrate that they know the information? Can we do it with a smaller group of kids so they're presenting? Because we want them to maybe gain that skill or get experience with it. But can we get them to the goal in a little bit of a different way, instead of holding them to a standard that really is setting them up to fail because of their own mental health or emotional challenges that kind of get in their way?
Right. Just a quick break. You're listening to WGTD HDFM. I'm your host, Karen Sconzert. This is Education Matters. This discussion of Kenosha Unified School District's school-based mental health program is archived at WGTD.org on the Education Matters page. You are invited to listen again, or you can find our WGTD Education Matters Facebook page and join in a discussion there. So I'm sure that a lot of families, for various reasons, things seem to be going well until the hormones really start to hit in puberty. So do you see new mental health issues arise, or changes in mental health status that come along with puberty?
I mean, I think if you have a kid that is already struggling with mental health concerns, puberty and hormonal changes can certainly exacerbate those difficulties. I think we would probably argue that most teenagers going through puberty appear a little
unbalanced, shall we say.
Can often appear as though they maybe have mental health concerns that really aren't necessarily mental health concerns, but it is just the nature of that terrible time in someone's life where puberty is present. So, I mean, certainly that can impact their, you know, depression and anxiety type symptoms could increase during that time. They are more moody. You're more likely to see family dynamic issues. Sometimes they struggle socially as they're trying to kind of find their own identity and individuate from their parents and from their peers and who are they kind of in life and in school and all that kind of stuff. So I wouldn't necessarily say that puberty causes mental health challenges, but it certainly could exacerbate them if they already have those or cause them to appear as though they are struggling with more mental health than maybe is truly there.
Right. Do you provide any training for teachers to spot issues like substance use, self-abuse, like cutting or suicidal behaviors?
I think there's pockets of training. I think the youth mental health first aid is a great one that's going to address some of those things. We, our school counselors and social workers, engage in monthly meetings where we often have speakers coming in and talking on specific issues like that, such as substance abuse, AODA issues, kind of in pockets here and there.
Right. Do you have resources outside the school to which you can refer students? This came from a former teacher. One of my friends wanted me to ask this question. Students who are unable to tell their parents they need help, particularly if maybe they're coming out, their sexual orientation is becoming, they're becoming aware of, and they don't feel like comfortable sharing that with their parents. I know we talked a little bit about the consent issues earlier, but in this one in particular, what if they don't feel safe saying anything?
I think the students that we've gotten referrals on that are around that particular issue, oftentimes it is the student presents to their, we call their person at school, so like their counselor, social worker, and they have done some work with him or her in the school building. And then potentially it's becoming more of an issue where the student's getting more concerned about their parents', you know, response if they should come out or things like that. Mm-hmm. So at times that referral then comes to us, and then we just kind of can provide a way to help the student decide, you know, what they want to do, work through their identity issues and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, LGBTQ training is provided to KUSD staff to help them, and you know, support staff in general to help them with students that have those issues, just to help them with safety and things like that.
Right. And then I suppose as they become of, you know, 18 or older, then they're making their own decisions about a lot of things, and so they can decide how to address their families, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's tricky, right, because we want to support the student without undermining families necessarily, and we really want to partner with them and help them.
Mm-hmm.
Be honest with their families and help support them in ways that maybe their families aren't. But it's that delicate balance of being very supportive without undermining parents and that kind of thing.
Right, which is true of teachers as well.
Yeah,
just
absolutely.
Like almost everything, you know, you're kind of mediating a relationship.
We've certainly had sessions where a student is ready to tell their parent, and so we have a session with a parent in the therapy office at school.
Mm-hmm.
Where we kind of help the student tell their parent, and then the therapist is there to, you know, provide support.
Mm-hmm.
Those have tended to go fairly well, and then also the support people at school are part of that as well, so they can continue to support the student after the session's over.
Okay. So it sounds like you're in 19 schools right now. Is that right? Did
17.
I add 17?
Yeah.
Oh, 17 total. Okay.
Yep.
So that's a lot of schools.
Yeah, we're very, very proud of that.
How do you assess the effectiveness of your program?
I think informally right now, just by the demand.
That
it's just well received. by families, school staff, and principals. So I think informally in that way. But now that we are in 17 schools and 2+ years into our partnership with PSG, we are starting to more formally gather different data and metrics to track students. So we, you know, are who's been in therapy, what are grades, what are attendance, what does that look like? Are we seeing a downward trend in office discipline referrals, just so we can kind of see how is potentially access to that service impacting them, their student life, and their ability to be engaged in their learning environment.
Yeah, so that would be that. Mm-hmm. That probably ultimately is why it's in schools, is to help them with their academic learning and sort of socially fitting in the school environment. So
right, it's foundational. Being socially, emotionally, mentally well and healthy is a foundation to, you know, promoting academic success.
Right, and then of course, it's hard to measure for many reasons. One of which is that it's one factor out of many. You know, there could be a whole lot of things going on in the other dozens of hours per week that they're not having therapy, right? So you don't really
know. Right, so we can't always draw that direct line that it was because of this therapy. And I think many of us believe that access to this, in addition to with all the other rich supports and opportunities that our students have, that in combination – when done well, we can help all kids. We were just recently gathering some data within the last month for a presentation on this, and I believe we're up to, this school year, over 260 students who are receiving direct therapy. And those are ones who have gone through the intake. Many more, I would say probably upwards of 400+ referrals are made for this year. But at last count from data from PSG, we have over 260 students in those 17 schools receiving direct service. So I think just numbers alone for me shows effectiveness too, that it's being well received and it's needed.
So do you just get, as a therapist, are you assigned a school or a group of schools? How does that work?
Most therapists are in more than one school. A lot of it depends upon need at each school and therapist availability, quite frankly. We, you know, with 400 plus referrals, we have a staff of about, what are we at now, about 18 therapists. So it's, you do the numbers, there's more referrals than there are therapists, so sometimes there's a balancing act there. But in those 17 schools, we have multiple therapists in each one of them.
Oh, I see. So because they move around from place to place, right?
Because there's no way to know how many referrals are going to come from a given school, right? We can start two schools at the exact same time. One school can give us 50 referrals in 2 weeks, and the other one can give us 10. So we can't leave a therapist planted somewhere just waiting for referrals. We move them where the referrals come from.
So I believe, did this start with a grant from the state? Is that how this got started, or how did it get started? I'm sorry, I'm conflating two ideas.
If you want to talk about that, Leah.
Yeah, it got started, honestly, just after some traumatic things that occurred in the district, I think, over that first school year, and we recognized that there was just significant mental health needs going on in our schools. And so it started really the way that it's structured now with those two pilot schools with Bolin and Bradford, and we just put a therapist in there, and then it has grown over those 2 years. We did have a grant.
Yeah, I mean, it's not grant dependent.
No.
Within Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction school-based mental health or school mental health framework, at the peak of that framework, when they're discussing intensive services for a few students, DPI promotes deepen collaboration between school districts and community mental health partners. And one of those ways to deepen that collaboration is through bringing these services into schools. And because it's children's and parents' insurance paying for it primarily, whatever insurance they have access to, that really minimizes any costs to the district. For us, it's just finding space. a little bit, I think a previous grant supported some equipment for the therapist for their office setting where they were seeing kids. Where the grant, the school-based mental health grant that the district had in the past came in handy and helpful was especially with the handful of students, as Leah mentioned before, who are underinsured or uninsured. But certainly doing this partnership can be done at well at no cost.
Yep. Right.
Okay.
Which I think makes it very attractive to school districts, community members, and school boards.
Right, right. Yeah, it just makes everything sort of fused together more seamlessly rather than saying, okay, school's where you do this thing, and then that's a separate thing, and you have to go far away in a car to get it. Right. So we actually only have about 3 minutes left, so I'm going to quickly ask, what are one or two of the most helpful things that teachers and friends can do or not do to support those around them with mental health challenges?
I think a big piece we often push is that the student in particular, or you know, the person is doing the best they can. They always do the best they can. It's not, they're not being manipulative, and they're not intentionally engaging in these behaviors that are caused by mental health issue. And for people to understand that this isn't necessarily in their control. And, you know, it doesn't always get better right away.
Right.
Sometimes it gets a little worse.
Before it gets better when
you get into treatment.
Right.
Yeah, and I think it's all about validating. We want to validate people where they're at. We want to validate their feelings. We don't necessarily need to validate the invalid. We don't have to validate maybe why they feel that way or that kind of thing, but to validate people and their thoughts and their feelings. And like Dana said, we firmly believe that people are doing the best that they can with some of the challenges that they have.
Right. And for educators to, as they work with kids, to really approach that from a place of empathy and compassion, because we don't always know for any of us what's under the surface. And so approach each day from an empathetic and compassionate and caring place.
Right. So the last one I have time for, listeners are always interested in knowing some stories that come out of local institutions. So can you tell us something about how students have been helped by this service?
I think the thing I like hearing the most is, you know, we talked a lot about we're seeing kids who have never been in services before. They've never had any kind of treatment. And so we hear pretty much on a daily basis of kids who are sharing things with their therapist and saying, I've never told anybody this before, or no one's ever listened to me, or no one has ever understood me the way you do. So for me, it's just about giving these kids a person in their life, a consistent person who cares about them and is empathetic and compassionate and validates them in all those different kind of ways to hopefully long-term help them kind of be successful academically, socially, just in life. And so that's what I enjoy hearing from therapists and kids on a regular basis.
That's great. Well, I want to thank you all for coming in and sharing all of this. My thanks to Bridget Kotarek of Kenosha Unified School District and Leah Featherstone and Dana Bilevsky from Professional Services Group. And this is, you've been listening to WGTD HDFM, and this is Education Matters. This discussion of Kenosha Unified School District's school-based mental health program is archived at WGTD.org. On the Education Matters page, we also have a Facebook page for Education Matters. It's WGTD:Education Matters. So search for us on Facebook and join in a discussion there. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks, Karen.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard each Saturday morning at 10:30 on WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archive programs are available on our website, WGTD.org, and you're invited to continue the discussion on the Education Matters Facebook page.
Support comes from Sweet Impact Chocolates, an eco-friendly producer of handmade truffles and caramels, where 10% of sales are donated to organizations helping disadvantaged women and children. Shop locally or online. SweetImpactChocolates.com.
Support comes from Kenosha Winter Harbor Market, featuring piccolo bread, baked fresh every Saturday morning at the Masonic Center, where the market is held from 10 until 2. Proceeds benefit the lodge. Piccolo bread is perfect for sandwiches, toast, snacking, and more.
From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar,
their Scene Symphony Orchestra and their Scene Choral Arts students will perform a Holiday Pops concert on Friday, December 6th at Festival Hall downtown. Doors open at 5:30. Visit racinesymphony.org.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911.